want you to welcome to the stage from Melbourne, Australia, Mr. John Smith. And I'm going to ask John just a couple of questions now. Just some of you heard John speak before, some of you know a bit about him, but I just want to just ask him a few things about himself, just to give you a bit of a taster. Sean and the band are going to come on soon, and then John will say some more stuff later on. But there's numerous things that...
Do I get to say some sweet, nice things about you too?
No, I'm not going to give you the chance this time. there's numerous things that have been associated with John, that fairly high-profile things. But I'm always fascinated by people whose faith takes them to the extreme. And, I mean, that can be a good thing and it can be a really bad thing. I mean, the whole New York business could be construed as faith to the extreme. But some years ago, John, you ended up in jail in the Philippines with an M16 shoved up your nose because you were prepared to stand up for the rights of some people that were being oppressed by the government there. What drives you to those kind of extremes that you do something like that?
Well, I don't know, mate. A long time ago, I had an experience. I suppose people who watched the Blues Brothers movie, it sort of sent in funny ways there, but you sense that you're on a mission from God. And for some of you, that might sound crazy. And maybe it is. Maybe those of us that are on a mission for anything are on the edge of craziness in terms of the society we're in. I just think that people who are comfortable with the way this world is, stuffed up like it is, who don't feel angry and stirred up and wanting to do something, I frankly think they're the people that are mentally in trouble. I don't think the people that end up sometimes in mental homes because they are so chewed up and screwed out by the way the world is, I don't think that's necessarily insane at all. I think it probably means that they're people that are sensitive enough to see how bad it really is. The Philippines is a kind of a situation that you don't really pick it up from the media, but it's a country of such extremes. In fact, when we got there were guys running around with T-shirts carrying M16s who had written on their T-shirts, "Kill a communist for Jesus," which is kind of pretty bizarre and off. But you've got the extreme right and the extreme left. And I guess, mate, when we got there and we saw women and children screaming and running in terror, with soldiers all around the place with guns and bulldozers pushing down their homes, it was probably a combination of a sense of a call of God to say, well, I don't want to leave this world the same way I found it when I came here. I mean, if nothing else happens, I guess I'd like to have stuck on my gravestone, "He left the world a little better than it would have been if he hadn't have shit stirred over the issues," you know. And the second thing is that I think just the sheer insanity of the situation that hit my eyes and my colleague's eyes, one of the other pastors from our church, just simply fired us off. And I mean, some of that may be a little bit Australian. I mean, Australians are people that, you know, we don't do the Yankee thing where they tell you you're wonderful, you know, for the moment they meet you, and then 10 minutes later, after they've worked out whether you can help them up their career path, and they decide you can't, and then they don't want to know you. Aussies, I think, are far more like Welshmen and Welshwomen in that they're not going to pretend they like you if they don't. You know, that's it. There's none of that sort of crap that goes on. And we Aussies are a little bit straightforward like that, and part of it was temperamental, I guess. I mean, I saw the thing and this is insane. You know, what do? You're not just going to stand here. You've got to do something. So we threw ourselves into it. But part of it's God, part of it's temperament, and part of it was just the situation. It was so incredibly insane. So you had to do something or feel that you relinquished your manhood, really, if you didn't do something. So basically, I guess that's... And I you know, I don't want to get all religious about it in a way that'll make people want to puke or anything, but let me say this tenderly, I really love Jesus. And that might sound crazy, but that man, you know, I melt in my heart when I look at him, when I look at what he did. I mean, he knew full well what was happening. He was no fool. He knew that he said public things that would get him nailed and crucified. And I just don't see that as a kind of smalsy religious thing. I see that as a magnificent thing that reflects to me what a man is meant to be in terms of commitment to your convictions and what you believe in. And I guess that's all part of it.
So the next question was going to be, I mean, Jesus has obviously been a huge role model for you. Who else has inspired you over the years?
Well, if I gave you the list of all people who inspired me, it would really be weird because they'd come from very, very different settings. I might get into trouble when I say this, but I'm moved by people like Martin Luther King at one end. And this will probably sound crazy for a Christian, but I'm moved by people like Che Guevara. Now, you know, there are things about him that obviously weren't Christian and kind of what you'd expect from a Christian man or anything like that. But guys that and women that are committed to something that will live, you know, in the jungles and live with every day having to shift, even if you mightn't believe in their belief system. You know, to see people that are committed for the sake of their people to try and overthrow oppression. Mm. I admire people like that. I admire Mother Teresa for one thing. I admire her for her just serving and loving people. But when she was asked whether she would sign a document against apartheid in South Africa, she wouldn't do it. She said she didn't want to be involved in any of that conflict. Now, I think she failed at that point. I think she's a wonderful woman, or was, who served and loved people. But I think there's also the other side. If there weren't people like Nelson Mandela, I mean, what was he, 27 years in jail, committed to that, you know? I mean, the system sucks. I mean, the very people that now say, oh, Nelson Mandela, you know, were the very people that called blokes like me 20 years ago communists because we were in public rallies calling for his release from prison. Mm. And, you know, the system really plays that game, you know? It's sort of, there's almost like there's a chart with the top 40 songs. There's a sort of a chart of what's the top 40 things you respond to. And I admire people that are committed for life. And that's why, you know, frankly, I probably feel more in common often with my biker mates that may have nothing to do with the Christianity, that may hate that side of things and think it's screwball. But I admire them from the standpoint that when you get in the midst of a club scene, there are people that are committed to one another and committed to something they believe in. And I like that. I mean, I think it matters what you believe. And, you know, S11 proves that. It really does matter what you believe, because you can believe stuff that causes you to just blow everybody up. That doesn't make it right. But I at least like to see people with conviction. On the other hand, books have affected me a lot. Victor Hugo, the French writer that wrote Les Miserables. I read that book at 10 years of age, about, 1,300 pages. And I read about that priest and how that guy got out of prison and he goes to the priest's house and he's going to rip off the guy's silverware. And the priest knows what he's doing. And when the cops come to drag him away, when the gendarmes turn up, the priest covers for him because he sees in this man who's angry and been brutalized by the prison system, he sees the possibilities of that man's life. And so he gives him a chance. And Jean Valjean's life is changed. Now, some people call that, you know, French romantic 18th century literature, and it's kind of, they joke about it now. But people's lives are changed like that, through a moment of someone giving them a chance, believing they could do it, and saying, you don't have to live where you are now. And that can spark someone off whose whole life has been shit all the way through to there, and bang, one encounter means their entire life changes directions. I love people that write books like that. I like people that can act as a catalyst in people's lives to transform them. And lastly, let me say, my own wife. I'm not an easy bloke to live with, simply because I think I suffer from ADHD from the look of things. If I'm really committed to something, I get fanatically fixated. But otherwise, when I was at school, they always gave me a report that said, Smith has got ability, but he doesn't concentrate. And nobody helped me with that. I didn't know what to do with that, and I hated school all the way through. And now when I'm doing a doctorate, I'm having all that trouble again, you know, because they want you to be disciplined and keep inside the box. And I sort of chase rabbits everywhere with ideas all over the place. But my wife, it hasn't been easy for her, and she's just been a wonderful partner. We've been 35 years together. We've had times when both of us have wondered whether it was worth it. And we've worked it through, and she's just a wonderful, tough, half Swede, half Scot, made of tough stuff, and she's stuck there with me. And then my dad. I mean, my dad's just a little guy that was a local Methodist minister.
And he and I don't agree. I mean, Dad is a Methodist, right? He doesn't believe in drinking. And like, I don't get pissed, but I really enjoy a beer. I enjoy a scotch, a good single malt. I enjoy a whiskey and all that stuff. And I keep control because the book says don't get drunk. So I don't get drunk. But I really enjoy all sorts of alcohol. My dad, every now and again, he writes me a letter and says, son, I worry about you drinking, you know? And he's a beautiful guy, though. I mean, just because we differ on that issue, my dad loves God, he loves people, and he's 85 years of age, and he can still give you a jolly good argument about politics or anything else. His mind's still alive. And he set me an example from childhood of being committed to something and working it through, and he helped me find the path to find God. And he's just a little local parson, you know. I've had articles in Le Matin and all sorts of journals and magazines. My dad's only ever been in the media when one day a journalist took a picture of him standing next to his son. It's the only time he's ever been there. He's never going to be writ up as a great man, but he is. He's one of those men that are the salt of the earth. So, I don't know, mate.
That's fantastic.
That's enough.
One last question. When we set up Zach's Place nearly 4 years ago, there were particular people we had in mind who we wanted to try and get alongside and help. And one of those groups of people that are into God, into Jesus, but they've been churned up and spat out the other end by church. And we didn't want to get these people together and have a good moan and be cynical. What would you say just to encourage those people? Do they give up? Do they give up on God just because of one bad experience? What do they do?
Well, if you can't handle the organised church, you could always create a disorganised one.
This is looking pretty good.
You know, one of the things, if you can't handle organised religion, and I feel mixed feelings about this, because if it wasn't for organised religion, we wouldn't have the book, we wouldn't have the story, we wouldn't have Martin Luther King, we wouldn't have Mother Teresa, we wouldn't have Francis of Assisi, we wouldn't have had Nelson Mandela. Even though he doesn't talk religion a lot, he said in 27 years, he went every week to the Methodist church service, and he said that was the biggest thing that kept him focused on seeking justice. We wouldn't have Lech Wałęsa in Poland. I know Lech's been sort of pushed aside and all, but let's face it, he jumped over the fence there for the union thing when communism was controlling there. He was a courageous bloke in that situation. There'd be so much we wouldn't have if there wasn't an organised way that the book could be kept and the ideas could be kept. But if you have trouble with organised church, let me remind you that the first 200 years of the Christian church, that's a little longer than any of us here are going to live, maybe close to 300 years, the average size of a church was a dozen people because they didn't have any buildings, mate. They met at home. And if you can't handle an organised, you know, institutional type church, then I reckon you get together and you kick this stuff around every week in your lounge room. In fact, I've got some friends in Ohio who have a church thing called Xenos, and you can look it up on your webpage. It's X-E-N-O-S. It's a Greek word from the New Testament. And these guys were radical hippies and stuff back in the 60s and early 70s. And they have, I don't know, a church membership of maybe, I don't know, 5,000 people, 6,000 people. I think it's the biggest church in Ohio. And what they do is their entire church is home church, you know. So they meet together, and if you get baptized, it's not kind of an institutional thing. It's your family. It's your mates that meet each week that go with you down to the river, and it means something. You can feel that organic thing. Instead of having evangelistic crusades, they have a night playing cards, listening to CDs, drinking beer, and they just invite their neighbours. And that's the way they talk about their faith. And it's kind of not phony. It's not put on people. It's not even as artificial as this. And it just sort of happens in a human way. Now, their entire church is built up of house churches. And when you go there on Sunday, they don't have any of this stuff of singing the songs or taking up the collection or any of that stuff. All they have is they've got a couple of brilliant performers that get up on stage, open up the old book and make the thing come alive, and then they shove a microphone around and people can ask questions of clarification, conflicting questions and questions of what are we going to do about it. And that's the only thing they do on Sunday. They don't do any of that other religious stuff. If you're going to break bread and have communion, you do it in the house church. If you're going to get baptized, you go with your house church group. If you're going to do evangelism to reach out to your mates about what you believe, you do it in the house. and you invite them around for a wine and cheese night or whatever. And I think if you have trouble with the institutional thing, then that's what you ought to do. The one thing I do believe is this. There is no such thing as dot-com Christianity. I don't buy that. Because if what Jesus is about is fixing us up so that we can discover each other and heal that mess that so much of humanity's in, then you can't live your Christianity without relationship. In fact, sometimes the outlaw club scene is strangely nearer to what church ought to be, where people are willing to die for each other, where people are willing to stand against what anyone else thinks to care for each other. When people want to be at the clubhouse six nights a week because that's where their mates are and they enjoy it. And if Christians aren't mates together, it's a joke. That's not real Christianity in my book. I don't think you can live faith on your own. You've got to live it with some kind of connectedness with other people that care about you. Now, if you can do that in an institutional form, great. If you can't, don't toss it out. And lastly, let me say this, mate. It's a little bit like family. I mean, if you're getting beaten up by the old man, if you're getting screwed by your uncle, obviously that's not a healthy family, you should quit. But, you know, you can have a family that's reasonably dysfunctional, where mum and dad argue too much and it'd be better if they didn't. But you know it's still better to have a family, even if it's a little bit dysfunctional. So I like what Martin Luther, the founder of the Lutheran denomination, said. He said about the church, because he thought it was a bit of a mess then too, and he said, well, she may be a whore, but she's still my mother. And I think that's a good word. So I got to have a mother. And that's, you know, it's meeting together in some form or another. If that comes out of this pub thing, and this became something where you built groups out of that, fantastic. Let it happen, but don't give up on it and don't go it alone, because I don't think any human being can really ever reach their potential going it alone. I don't care who they are. We need others. We need to have to put up with others that really get up our noses so that we can really deal with us and our reactions. You need to have close relationship with some people to be able to sort that stuff out.
Fantastic. Give it up for John Smith.
Thank you.
We'll hear more from John in a little while.